have time for questions and you wait for Carl, and when you use a microphone, hold it horizontally. That may help. So, the gentleman in red.
Why no development next to the light rail in Portland? You said nobody built apartments next to them. Why?
Well, the simple answer is there isn't that big of a market for people who want to live in high-density housing next to the light rail. There is a market for it. I'm not saying there's no market for it, but the market was already saturated by existing high-density housing in the core area. We didn't need to build a lot more because people didn't want to live there, even though housing prices were increasing during most of that time, single-family housing prices.
Let me see, sort of two related questions. Reason had a generally sympathetic interview with Jane Jacobs, and the first city she mentioned as an example of a good urban area was Portland, which was very surprising after reading your articles in Reason. A related question, what's the political climate in Portland after these changes, and why is her impression so different than yours?
I don't know that Jane Jacobs has ever been to Portland. One of the best reviews of Jane Jacobs' book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, was by a sociologist named Herbert Gans, who wrote a book called The Levittowners, and also, what was his other book? The West End. It was about the West End in Boston. But anyway, he said that a lot of people come into cities as tourists, and they see them through tourist eyes, and they try to say, hey, this is a beautiful place. I'd love to live here because it's so much fun to be. It's so entertaining. But residents don't have tourist eyes. They want serviceability, not entertainment. And that means they want to be able to get around the urban area in their automobile. They don't want to be confined to a light rail or whatever. So you can go into downtown Portland and ride the light rail to the edge of downtown and say, wow, this is cute. But you find out, hey, hardly anybody in Portland uses the light rail because it doesn't serve their needs. So I would say that Jane Jacobs is she's a hardcore central city person. While she criticizes planners, she also criticizes the suburbs, and I think she's off target there. What do Portlanders think of this? Their attitudes are pretty mixed. The polls show that if you ask them tomorrow, would they support the current urban growth boundary or a slight expansion or a big expansion? The majority would say no expansion. And if you ask them tomorrow, where do you want to live? In the inner city, in the low-density suburbs, or the very low-density rural areas, the exact same majority wants to live in the rural areas. And a majority of the remainder wants to live in the suburbs. So it's like light rail. We're for light rail so that somebody else will ride it and make the highways less congested. We're for high-density development so that somebody else can live there and I can live out in the rural areas with the birds and the bees.
Thank you, gentlemen. I think better addressed to Mr. Klein. There is a popular myth all over the country, especially in the Bay Area, that General Motors shut down public transit. They just did horrible things, and public transit would be all over this country if it wasn't for the evil capitalist General Motors running the bus companies out of business in L.A. and buying them out, et cetera. Can you address the historical facts around that, please?
There's an article that answers this question, which I want to refer you to. It's by a Portland scholar, Cy Adler, and it's called Something Something and Roger Rabbit, the name of the article, in this academic journal. And he goes through and just shows that, no, it made sense to close down those things. And there was politics and stuff, but he's gone through it, and, you know, it's basically an urban legend. Randy, can you add to this?
It's the same thing. Scott Bottles, a UC scholar, has written a book on the same subject. Basically, the truth is General Motors and some other companies bought interest in transit companies around the country because the transit companies were trashing their rail lines, their streetcar lines, and buying buses. And all General Motors wanted to do was to make sure that when they bought buses, they bought General Motors buses instead of somebody else's buses. And they got taken to court for an antitrust violation, and they were convicted and fined $5,000. And so they got rid of the transit companies. But the ironic thing is Roger Rabbit is about the Pacific Electric in California. General Motors did not buy Pacific Electric. The Pacific Electric lines were ultimately, the streetcar lines were torn out and replaced with buses by the Los Angeles Metropolitan Transit Authority after it purchased Pacific Electric. So it was the government that got rid of the Roger Rabbit lines.
This question is for Mr. O'Toole. I noticed in a couple of slides you had a map of the state up there, and I think it's important to note that the state of Oregon, it's important to note that the urban growth boundary policy that's implemented by Metro Portland is really implemented vis-a-vis a state statute and mandate to do so. In your experience, examining obviously very closely kind of the dynamic, the growth dynamic involved in an area that has such a stringent urban growth boundary policy, what have you observed about Vancouver, Washington, just to the north across the river, where you don't have that same state mandate, and therefore you probably, I'm assuming, you'd have some interesting side effects or unintended consequences?
Well, one of the quickest unintended consequences is that although the Portland area grew at 2% a year over the last decade, the Vancouver area grew about 12 or 13% a year. It tripled in size because people who were working in Portland found that they wanted to live in a place that wasn't so regulated and, incidentally, not so heavily taxed. So they moved to Vancouver, and then they commute to Portland. Other interesting thing is that the other cities, every city in Oregon has an urban growth boundary, but the big cities are tracked by the National Association of Home Builders, Salem, Eugene, and Medford, and they are also in the top 20 least affordable cities, urban areas in the country, least affordable housing markets. And it's interesting, you look at the least affordable top 20, and they are almost all cities in California, Oregon, and Texas. In Texas, the cities are mostly border cities, and I think the reason why they're unaffordable is because there's a lot of immigrants who are not yet earning American dollars, and yet they're living there, and mm-hmm. so they can't afford mm-hmm. to buy a house. But in California, we have unaffordable cities because we have anti-smart growth. We have government policies aimed at making densities less than the market density. And in Portland, we have unaffordable housing because we have government policies aimed at making density higher than the market density. If we would let the market work in both cases, we could have more affordable housing.
Hi, this is the first time for me to come to one of these meetings, and I just decided to go back to school after 40 years, and in this meeting I've decided that there's a lot of things I don't know, and one of the things that I find very curious is I see all the statistics for mass rail transit, but I don't see them set up to compare to statistics for highway cost. I hear a lot of people in this country, I just spent 12 years in Japan, talking about how many railroads pay for themselves. I can't understand how many highways pay for themselves in this country. And if we take the cost of your car, the cost of your gasoline, the cost of your insurance, the time that you spend, not in Portland necessarily or in Las Vegas necessarily, but say on 880 out here commuting between Berkeley and San Jose, how much is it worth to take your life in your hands every day on an hour and a half long commute, paying high gasoline prices, high car prices, and so forth?
Well, that's and a very nice speech, and it encapsulates
a lot.
It's
not a speech. It's not a speech. It's a question.
It's a question. It's a very nice question. It encapsulates a lot of the myths about automobiles. Number one, safety. Urban freeways are just about the safest form of urban transportation there is. The fatality rate due to light rail transit is 3 times greater than the fatality rate due to urban freeways per billion passenger miles. Number two, cost. The cost of an urban freeway is roughly $5 to $10 million per lane mile. And if you have to do a lot of bridge work, it gets to be higher sometimes, and you've got some really exceptionally expensive things like the Big Dig, the Central Artery Project in Boston, which is a bunch of tunneling, but generally the average cost is about $5 to $10 million per lane mile. Meanwhile, the average cost of light rail is about $50 million a mile. The average cost of heavy rail, like BART, is $100 million a mile. So you have to ask, is light rail carrying 5 times as many people as a freeway lane? Is BART carrying 10 times? No, they're generally carrying less than a third as many.
But that doesn't include the price of cars, the operating costs.
All right, let's talk about those costs. Today, Americans drive 4 times as many miles as they did in 1960. But as a share of our income, all the costs associated with the automobile are less today than they were in 1960. Today, we spend about 15% of our income on automobiles, all the costs, gasoline, cars, oil, repair, insurance, everything. In 1960, it was closer to 20%. So the cost has been declining, even though we drive 4 times as much. And then there's the idea that, oh, we waste all our time on the freeway and in congestion. The average amount of time people spend commuting is about 23 or 24 minutes each way. That's by automobile. For mass transit, it's much, much higher. So those people who choose or are forced to use mass transit tend to spend a lot more time commuting. And maybe they can get a little bit of reading done on it, but it's nowhere near as comfortable or as pleasant a journey often as it is by automobile.
Can I just follow up?
Sure.
Just page 12 of my handout does make the kind of comparison you're asking for, where they compute the annualized cost of new starts in rail projects. And I pulled this right off Randall Cox's webpage.
Wendell
Cox's, sorry. He's saying you can lease cars at cheaper rates for these new passengers. Now, when you phrased your question, you also said that they don't pay for themselves.
Oh, that was the other thing. Right.
Is that, the government runs a government highway and they don't charge for it. Sure, it doesn't raise revenue, but that's in the nature of the way they've set up the service.
But it doesn't apply equally to trains. And the same standards are not held to automobiles and cars and that form of transportation as we attempt to hold trains and mass transit to.
What do you mean standards?
We expect trains and train lines to be privatized and to pay for themselves and to get out from government subsidies. And we don't hold highways and roads and bridges to the same standard.
Well, now it sounds like you're with us.
That's right.
We should privatize the highways.
We're doing a book on that whole issue.
Mark DeLucci is a University of California, he's an economist, right? And he's looked at the cost of highways and the cost of automobiles compared to the cost of mass transit. And what he's concluded is people who advocate mass transit better not raise this issue, because the subsidies to mass transit average about 45 cents a passenger mile. The subsidies to highways average about a tenth of a penny per passenger mile. Even when you include all the social costs of highways, air pollution, water pollution, noise pollution, everything else, he estimates they only average about 5 cents a passenger mile. That's about 10% of the subsidy to mass transit, and then mass transit has social costs too. So overall, the automobile wins out. And I want to point out that I'm saying this not because I love to drive. I don't. I bicycled here. And by the way, you have your office in a rather bicycle unfriendly neighborhood, I have to say. I ride BART and the bicycle to work every day, and it's another curious thing. I have 2 ways of going. One way, I bicycle 15 miles and BART 11, and the other way, I bicycle 7 miles and BART 26, and it turns out I bicycle faster than BART. I get there quicker if I bicycle 15 and BART 11. I've never in my life commuted to work by automobiles, and I love trains. I just don't love paying for somebody else's hobby.
This gentleman right here.
I was always under the impression that Europe was already congested when the transportation systems, automobile and train, were brought into the economy, and therefore they developed mass transit and trains and very efficient trains for greater reason, because they already had the population congestion, whereas we did not have. Now we are entering into that in our urban areas, and it would seem that what they have could be emulated, but your figures seem to go contrary to that. How do you compare Europe?
Well, except for Manhattan, we don't have any part of this country, even San Francisco, that is as dense as some of the urban areas in Europe. So the central core of Paris, London, Amsterdam, and these other urban areas are much higher densities than any urban areas in the United States. But when you look at what Europe has done, after World War II, most Western European nations made a very conscious decision to do what we today call smart growth. They promoted high-density housing. They discouraged low-density housing. They subsidized mass transit. They heavily taxed automobiles and petrol. And as a result, they implemented smart growth essentially 55 years ago. And what do we see today? Today you look at European cities, people are moving out of the city center, they're moving into the suburbs, they're buying single-family homes, automobile ownership and automobile driving is increasing three times as fast as in the United States. The almost every city center, Paris, London, whatever, is declining in population. The urban areas are declining in density. Mass transit in almost everyone except for Stockholm is stagnant or declining in terms of actual use. And in terms of market share, it's declining rapidly because automobile use is increasing so fast. So smart growth doesn't work in Europe. Why would we expect it to work here?
Yeah, this is my first time here as well. And coincidentally, I'm also going to take the devil's advocate position a little bit. Daniel Klein, it seemed to me when you were talking about people's reasons for wanting mass transit, to me it felt like there's really something missing there. You know, I'm a libertarian. I believe in free enterprise. I don't want government control. But aesthetically, I definitely prefer the idea of mass transit and high density. And I know that I'm not the only libertarian who feels this way. There's a website called New Colonist, I think it's .com, might be .org, that talks about city living and touts mass transit and density and this kind of thing. There's something there, and it's not quite clear to me exactly what it is, but one thing that I think enters into this equation is that, you know, we're looking at a system where automobile traffic is largely free enterprise, and mass transit is largely government controlled and regulated. So in a sense, it should be no surprise that the statistics we have show that mass transit is much more expensive, inefficient, and everything else compared to the automobile. If it was the other way around, if we had competing mass transit companies and the government owned all the cars and you had to go to specific places to pick up your car and, you know, lease it from the state and this kind of thing, you know, imagine what it would be like. I think that part of what we're looking at is a result of the economic system we set up and not inherent inefficiencies or problems with mass transit. Also, regarding the density...
Do you have a question?
No, I have really more of a speech, actually. If you want to, I'll assume that one of your speakers can find a question in there somewhere. I guess I'd like to hear you address a little bit the idea of why couldn't we have more density like Amsterdam, London, Manhattan in this country so that mass transit was more effective, and why couldn't we privatize mass transit and have more buses and trains run by competing companies instead of just going to a suburban automobile kind of model?
I want to take a piece of that. I asked Randall to get a picture here of the traffic jam on the highway. I don't know if it's going to warm up in time. But you saw pictures of the traffic congestion on the highway, which you call the transportation private sector, free enterprise sector. When you see that traffic jam on the highway, you see it? When you see that traffic jam on the highway, you should think bakery shop in Russia with a line going around the block. Okay? You are looking not at a car problem, you're looking at a socialist highway problem. Okay? We do not have anything like a free enterprise automobile system at all. Just because the automobiles are privately owned, the infrastructure, the important part of the whole system, is a socialist enterprise. And what you see here is what happens when they socialize groceries or housing or anything else. The exact same thing, exact same cause, exact same effects. Sure, let's get rid of that. If we privatize highways and have markets for highways, they'll be more aesthetic. Now, as for the demand for aesthetic urban environments, Randy, do you want to address that one?
Well, I'm reminded of a an article that was posted on the web by, I'm embarrassed to say, a University of California, Berkeley economics professor. And he said that when he was first hired at Berkeley, at the income he was given, he had a choice between buying a two-bedroom house on a small lot in Berkeley or a four-bedroom house on a five-acre lot in Lafayette. And so, naturally, he bought the four-bedroom house in Lafayette. And then when he sometimes goes for a walk on the beautiful open space that's behind his house, he goes up the hill and he looks down at Highway 24 and sees all the traffic jams of people driving into Berkeley. And he says, why couldn't we just have higher densities in Berkeley and San Francisco so that people wouldn't have to be jamming up the highway that I have to drive in to get to work every day? Now, I think there's a lot of people who think that high density is fine. I don't have any objection to high density, as long as it's what people want. And if people want to live there and a developer builds it for them, that's fine. If people want to live there, the developer will build it for them. What we have in Portland is mandatory, legislated high density. These mid-rise developments that are so heavily subsidized, they have 11 and 12% vacancy rates, which are unheard of in the Portland area. Most places have 2 and 3% vacancy rates. People don't want to live in those kinds of densities. Some people do, but the market for them is already saturated. There's already plenty for them available.
I thought I heard you say, when you were talking about the relative unaffordability of California housing, that there were zoning restrictions that prevented higher density. Did I hear that correctly? And if so, could you speak to that?
Yes, there are in many communities. Some communities have passed the ballot measures that say if you want to build a high-density development, you can only do it after getting a vote of the people supporting it. It's not enough to get your planning commission to approve it. Any density is restricted. The regional parks that we see all over the place are essentially a weapon against density. If we put in a lot of big parks, then you won't be able to put in housing there, and so the highways around the parks will be less congested. There is a movement for density, and the Metropolitan Transportation Commission is promoting smart growth and so on and so forth, but mostly the density that we see in this area is a result of high land cost as a result of all the low density restrictions and the purchases of open space and so on and so forth.
I want to add something about understanding the forces behind restrictions on the housing supply, and that's that there's a very significant element of what Aaron Adrian, the author of this working paper on Silicon Valley, calls the Goldfinger tactic. Now, if you remember the James Bond movie Goldfinger, the villain Goldfinger is going to enrich himself not by stealing anything, but by destroying a huge stock of the gold supply, namely blowing up a nuclear bomb in Fort Knox, which would shift back the supply curve of gold, drive up the price of gold, which he happened to have a lot of, and enrich himself. And that's a very important phenomenon in housing market restrictions. Homeowners do not want to see competitors. Okay, they do not want to see new housing supply come on the market, because that's competitors against very often their major asset, their own home. And so the homeowners, you know, the ones in town, the ones who have the power to control policy to a great extent or to influence it, they're gold fingers, essentially. And they're destroying the property rights of potential competitors. And that's what a lot of housing restrictions are really about. Yeah, it's NIMBY, but it's not so much, it's NIMBY sometimes more like, I don't want to see that in my backyard. This is more like, I don't want competitors, you know, who are also offering housing to my potential buyer.
There have been two good books on this very subject, on the effects of the housing market in the Bay Area of these kinds of restrictions. One was the Environmental Protection Hustle. And the other was, what was Suburban something?
Squeeze.
Suburban Squeeze. It's a more recent book. One of the books points out that it's so easy to object to and stop a new housing development in the Bay Area that a Boy Scout once stopped a condominium proposal in order to earn a merit badge.
This is a question for both of you. I was a little bit late to this meeting. in part because I encountered what my colleague Joe Furig refers to as a pricing problem on the freeways. And I think you've both done a wonderful job of exploding some of the myths about urban planning. What I would like to hear more about is whether you feel that the mispricing of the roads has caused any distortions. I get the impression from both of your presentations that outside of traffic congestion, if the roads were properly priced, things wouldn't be very much different. I have an intuition that's maybe false, that the mispricing of roads has also affected choices about where people live, how far away they are from their jobs, and so I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that.
And where the roads are.
Well, I think that if we corrected the pricing, things would be very different, but I can't predict exactly how different they would be. I would be willing to let the chips fall where they may. However, I do want to say that the advocates of smart growth often talk about the subsidies to sprawl. And I've looked as hard as I can to try to find all those subsidies, and there are some there. And then I've taken a look to see what subsidies there are to high-density inner cities. And as near as I can tell, cities, states, and federal government, and the federal government, are subsidizing high-density inner cities at the rate of about $10 for every dollar they give to low-density sprawl. So if we took away all the subsidies and put things on a user fee basis, my guess is that it would not curb low-density development. It might actually accelerate it.
One little point is that if the roads were priced, it's true that people would now be paying road charges, but they would be spending less time in traffic jams, so that might induce them to move even further out.
Hi. Isn't one of the possible distinctions, as I recall, Oregon doesn't have a property tax?
You recall wrong.
They do.
Okay. Sales tax.
No sales tax.
Yeah.
Okay. What are the relative rates on property taxes between Oregon and California?
I don't know. I know that Oregon's property taxes are about twice as high as in Washington, which has no income tax.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we have had our proposition, what is it, Proposition 13 down here, we had ours that was called 5 that put a limit on property taxes, but they're still pretty high.
The reason I was asking was related to the unit cost versus revenue phenomena, where around here they can push up the cost of all of the housing by putting restrictions on it by whatever means, and the higher pricing increases total revenue to local government. And so what I was wondering was is if the relationship, the inverse relationship between acreage minimums here, for example, and the high density stuff you were seeing in the Portland area might be just two different revenue strategies in some respects from exercised by local government.
I think that that does play into it, but I also think that there's a lot of people out there who are supporting smart growth, and they each have their own agendas. Some people support smart growth because they think automobiles are evil, so they want to create more congestion to punish you for driving. Other people support smart growth because they want to save the countryside, and so they want to pack you into cities so that you can't go out and trample on the countryside that they want to save for themselves. Other people want smart growth because they are downtown property owners, and they figure those suburban shopping malls have been stealing all their business, and if we can just make it as congested in the suburbs as it is in downtown, then people will stop going to the suburbs and they'll start shopping and moving their offices downtown again. There's all kinds of reasons for supporting smart growth. None of them are very noble.
How about the lady right there? Just wait a second.
Making buses act more like cars. Well, I sat all morning at an MTC meeting when they were trying to implement their 25-year plan, and I heard at least three people say that their mass transit does not work for them, and couldn't they do something more about these ideas about having neighborhood rental cars? And I thought, well, in our town of Alameda, we don't have BART, we don't have rail, and they're spending all of this money taking BART everywhere and at the expense of buses, and people don't ride buses anyway, but they come to Alameda kind of empty. I think Seattle likes buses better than the Bay Area does. But I think if they went where we wanted them to go, if they were more like environmentally friendly, if they were smaller, if they were, ran more often rather than six at a time, coming through the crowded parts of Berkeley and Oakland, bring us about five buses at a time and then nothing for an hour, you know. Anyway, if we had things that ran around, 40% of our travel in Alameda is within the city itself, doesn't even leave the city. So I wonder how you promote better bus transportation and make it work for us, because there is a need.
Absolutely. You can think of vans as small buses. You can think of them running along routes or running under subscription according to what their customers do on a regular basis. Another important point is that a lot of cars are going into work, going along routes, and have three empty seats. Okay? And one of the ideas in CurbRights is that these CurbRight entrepreneurs could allow an ordinary motorist to put up a sign and says, I'm a jitney this afternoon. I'm on my way to work. And he's got his safety inspection. He's got his certificate of who he is, that he's registered with the system. And you can get into his car, and there could be signage and whatnot, or just understanding that certain, that's one thing they would do at these curb zones and bus stops, is give you the information about where these things are going, what these different signs mean. There's a tremendous amount of capacity unused in cars. Okay, and that's why I say, in a sense, on the spot carpooling, jitneys, vans, buses, this is all a continuum. Okay, and we could have much more entrepreneurial transit, but there's just laws that say no. Okay, taxis too are part of that. So yeah, it could be much more that way, and it's just not allowed.
I also want to add that the federal government has created some perverse incentives for transit agencies. The federal government will fund capital costs, but they're very reluctant to fund operating costs. So if you're a transit agency and you have a choice between buying one 40 or 60 passenger bus or 10 vans, which you can do for the same price, well, if you buy 10 vans, that means you have to have 10 people, 10 drivers, and that increases your operating costs. So it's just cheaper to buy the 40 passenger bus, so you end up with all these big buses running around, not very frequent and pretty empty, when you could do the same job a lot more frequently and get a lot more, provide a lot more service with the 10 passenger or 20 passenger vans. So if the federal government just gets out of the transit business altogether, we'll get rid of that perverse incentive, and we might have some more creative activities on the part of transit agencies. Rail transit is the same thing. The transit agencies discovered, hey, we can hold up the federal government for $1 billion and build a big rail line instead of just $200,000 to buy a bus, and we provide exactly the same service as we could get with 10 or 20 buses, but hey, we got a chance to get all this money out of the federal government.
So, Randall O'Toole, when you were looking at the subsidies to city center versus suburbs, did you take into account the property tax, which falls on two types of property, the buildings and improvements and on the land? And when it falls on the improvements, it's actually a penalty on building taller, because you're punishing vertical transit, you're punishing, higher buildings, because the more you build, the more you're taxed. So that's a disincentive to higher density.
Well, that I don't think that's a subsidy.
No, it's a disincentive.
Yeah, yeah.
The property tax system punishes you for building higher. So in other words, it indirectly subsidizes the fringes by penalizing the center.
So we're agreed it's not a subsidy. You think it's a disincentive.
Right.
All right. Well, it turns out when you tax residential development, low-density residential, the most of the taxes are going for schools. And low-density residential development can pay for itself. In other words, the taxes coming from low-density residential development pays for the schools. But high-density residential development, the tax per unit, per dwelling unit, isn't as great. If you've got, a 20-unit apartment, the tax per dwelling unit isn't as great as it is for a big housing development. So the high-density development does not pay for itself.
So you're much more likely to be talking about subsidies to high density development through property taxes than through low density development. So if you're concerned about disincentives, I'd say governments are very right to have a disincentive to have high density development because it imposes more costs on them than they can afford to pay.
Well, another thing is utilities. If you charge the same, say, for water to on the fringe than in the center, it costs more to pipe water to the edge than in the center where the main source of the water is, doesn't it? And yet, so in that way...
Actually, the additional cost is so negligible, it's not going to make a difference. What turns out really costs you is if you take a low-density area and rezone it for high density, you will usually have to go in and tear up all the streets and put in bigger sewer mains, put in bigger water mains, and put in more infrastructure, tear down some houses to put in schools, and that costs you a lot more per unit than simply developing new low density on the urban fringe. So we hear about the cost of sprawl, but most of the studies of cost of sprawl have been hypothetical. When you actually sit down and look at it, the numbers show that the actual costs of urban services are greater in higher density areas than low density areas. And there was a study done by Dr. Helen Ladd at Duke University that showed this to be true.
Okay. Well, I didn't want to be the only one here who didn't get a question in. So in your answers about highways paying for themselves, it's my impression that the gas tax pays for a substantial portion of not only the highway construction, but also heavily subsidizes transit. So in terms of the answer to the issue of, you know, what is subsidized and what isn't, my thought was the gas tax covers a lot of that cost, and some of that gas tax money never even makes it to highway funding. It winds up in the general fund. So that just as a background. Now my question is, I think it's fairly obvious and there's consensus among experts that there's a long-run real increase in energy costs that we're facing. And what is the impact going to be on the automobile city of having substantial increases in energy costs, say, 50 years from now?
The simple answer is the impact is going to be we're going to buy more fuel-efficient cars. We had the energy crunches in the 1970s. By 1990, people were driving, 50% more than they were in the late 1970s and using less fuel total because we were driving more fuel-efficient cars. Now we have these hybrid electric vehicles coming out, the Toyota Prius, which Toyota sold 19,000 of last year, and they promised they're going to sell 300,000 of in 2 years. The Honda Insight, they get twice the fuel economy of an ordinary gasoline car, and they produce less than 10% of the pollution of an ordinary 2001 gasoline car, less than 1% of the pollution of a pre-catalytic converter gasoline car. So the problems with air pollution are going to go away. The problems with fuel running out of, you know, fuel costs are going to go away. What we're going to have, though, is a problem of how are we going to pay for those highways out of gas taxes when people are driving more and more fuel-efficient cars. We're going to have to turn to the kind of toll systems that Dan has been talking about.
Dan, do you want to comment on the gasoline tax issue and how that relates to...
No, not particularly. You're right. I mean, that doesn't really change what I said about it not being a free enterprise system. It's not taxing usage of the road. It's not taxed by time. You know, you're not paying by time, by where you're driving, when you're driving. So it's not rationing the way prices need to ration scarcity. It pays for itself the same way as if everybody in this room just paid $1,000 a week to Safeway, and then they could go in a store and take anything
exactly.
They wanted, you know? And we'd all take the filet mignon, and everybody would leave the hamburger behind, and that's what happens with our freeways.
So what happens to public good?
It's only a public good because we're not pricing it correctly. It's not really a public good.
You mean a public good in the strict economic sense of the term? No, the answer is simply no. It's very low cost to exclude non-payers. It's as easy as excluding non-payers at movie theaters. Is movie theater a public good?
Is food? Or is housing?
Well, a movie theater at least has a joint kind of experience. But you can exclude non-payers. You can charge for it. You can get supply to respond to demand because demanders have to pay to get it.
Are you talking about toll roads like they have in the East?
You could have,
but not like they have in the East. There would be electronic tolling, so you wouldn't have to stop at a toll booth, and they'd be value pricing, so you'd pay more during peak periods than you pay during off periods.
Let's put it this way. If the government ran movie theaters and charged nothing, would you call those public goods?
One more question. There's a gentleman right back here.
Where's the question?
Did you still have a question?
I was just going to ask you.
You talked a lot of innovative concepts, but I keep hearing in the background obstacles to implementing any of these things, and I'm just wondering, do you have any kind of brilliant ideas about the internal dynamics of bureaucracies or government that impede, for instance, the case of the jitney, which is a great concept that's obvious to just about anybody, but there are obviously some forces in place that prevent that from happening, you know? And I'm just wondering whether you can go into a little detail about how you would convince those that would resist it to
just wish board. David Thoreau all the health and prosperity of his institute, and then many are going to imitate his important social function.
Thank you, Dan. I'm going to thank our two speakers. As you can see, the topic is quite interesting and quite relevant. So if everyone would join with me in thanking them. Again, for those of you who have not gotten either of the books, there are copies upstairs, and I hope you will. They'd be happy to autograph copies. And we look forward to seeing you at our next event. Thanks for coming.